Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll learn all about a new city that's already under construction in Madera County along Highway 41, Rio Mesa. It one day could be the site of 30,000 new homes. We'll learn what the rest of the county has to say about it. Plus, we'll find out about a new project in Bakersfield that aims to raise awareness about human trafficking through a new coffee shop that gives jobs to victims. Later in the show, we'll talk about high-speed rail and find out what lessons China's bullet train projects could offer to California. And we'll learn more about how Visalia's Cahuilla Delta Medical Center is expanding its partnership with Valley Children's Hospital and what it means for expectant moms in Tulare County. But first, part two in our series we started last week about the San Joaquin Valley's opioid epidemic. The region has higher than average rates of painkiller prescriptions and hundreds of overdose deaths every year. This week we learn about three strategies that health officials are using to take aim at the problem. FM 89's Carrie Klein begins at a safe space for drug users.
For over 20 years, meth and heroin users from around Fresno County have relied on the Fresno Needle Exchange for free medical care and all the clean syringes they need.
About 30?
Okay. Now, users can also get something else here, a nasal spray that can reverse an opioid overdose. 3 months ago, volunteers began handing out Narcan prescriptions to visitors at the exchange.
Hello, sir. Did you know about Narcan before this?
Yes.
Okay.
Like an EpiPen to an allergic reaction, Narcan can stop an opioid overdose in its tracks. Doug, a heroin user, has seen the antidote in action.
I had a friend this weekend. He had overdosed. He was dead, heart stopped, turned blue.
A neighbor ran in with Narcan. Doug says by the time the ambulance arrived, his friend was already breathing and awake.
And to see him just even the next day after coming home from the hospital, it was surreal because I was looking at him and he was dead. And to see him up and walking around the next day is just unbelievable.
Narcan doesn't work with meth or other non-opioid drugs, but UC San Francisco med student Jeff Wells says volunteers offer a prescription to every person here, no matter their drug of choice.
We also started handing out these prescriptions with the idea of a herd immunity effect, where if enough people, even if they don't use opioids, have access to Narcan, then they can save someone's life.
Making Narcan visible is one of three tactics being taken by the Central Valley Opioid Safety Coalition. It's a group of health officials and advocates from Fresno and Madera counties. The coalition's other priorities include increasing access to addiction treatment and teaching doctors how to better prescribe painkillers. Fresno County Health Officer Ken Bird says the overall goal is not just to reduce opioid deaths, but also to educate everyone on how to prevent addiction in the first place.
Educating providers and making sure they have the knowledge they need to deal with pain management is one thing, but we want the public to be aware that they have a role in this as well.
The first priority of the coalition, Narcan, has been widely hailed as an essential weapon against opioid overdoses. It's been around for decades, but hasn't always been cheap or readily available. Just this past October, the nasal spray gained coverage under Medi-Cal, and the Fresno Needle Exchange, which is not currently a part of the coalition, immediately began prescribing it. Since October, they've handed out close to 700 prescriptions. When it comes to actually using Narcan, Fresno County estimates that its paramedics administered the drug about 250 times in 2016. The coalition's second overdose-fighting tactic is to increase access to medically assisted treatment, though they're still strategizing how that will happen. Dr. Mark Lasher is thrilled about the potential. He's medical director of Aegis Treatment Centers in Fresno and Merced, where he's been treating addicts for over a decade.
This is the war in drugs. This is the front line.
He says prioritizing this kind of treatment represents a culture shift in how we approach addiction.
we're first just starting to come to the conclusion that this is a brain disease, that this is something that's in the health realm and not something that, you know, should just be dealt with as lock them up and send them away.
But the coalition's third priority and their focus for the last few months has been educating doctors about the problem. In January, the county finished a series of lectures on safely prescribing painkillers.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, honor to be here.
Dr. Ronit Lev is an emergency room physician in San Diego. She presented the third lecture to an audience of about 200 doctors and pharmacists.
And guess what? The pills that we write for with good intention and we fill with good intention does not always end up in the hands that we expect them to.
She advises doctors to look out for signs of addiction and doctor shopping and to prescribe opioids cautiously and only when necessary.
I really believe that physicians and patients are victims of this epidemic. It's not that we've trained all these bad physicians in the United States. In a way, the issue of pain has been legislated upon the medical community, but now we have a serious problem on our hands.
She's excited about the attention opioids are getting in the San Joaquin Valley, but she cautions there's a long road ahead.
Once you have a problem, you're always behind. Oh, y'all are behind. So I think that nobody is ahead.
Now that their medical lectures have finished, the coalition's next steps include getting more word out to the public about opioid addiction and bringing in more groups from counties beyond Fresno and Madera. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. An explosion of building is ramping up just north of Fresno in Madera County. This area of rolling hills on the way to Yosemite could become a city the size of Clovis. All this development could be good for the county's finances, but as FM89's Ezra David Romero reports, people who already live there say it could change their way of life.
Kimberly Gomes is a realtor who grew up in the Madera Ranchos, an unincorporated community of less than 10,000 people just minutes from Fresno. It's been around for decades, and it's kind of a rural place with homes on lots of around an acre or more. Gomes is showing me a lot she just sold to a developer for $54,000.
So it's really pretty out here.
Oh, it's beautiful. Sitting out on your front porch, enjoying your coffee, listening to the animals.
She says this feeling of home is why people live here. Residents are able to live near Fresno while maintaining a country-esque lifestyle. Many people here have horses and farm animals, but Gomes says that way of life may be at risk.
People like the small town feel, and they live there to experience the country living, and they're afraid that it'll become too city-like. They moved out there to avoid that.
She's concerned because just a few miles southeast of here, a development of 6,600 homes called Riverstone is being built. It's the first of many subdivisions, and it's all part of the Rio Mesa area plan. It could add as many as 30,000 homes in the county over 30 years. Riverstone will look a lot like a typical subdivision in North Fresno, but much denser than the ranchos. There's also other developments near here in both Fresno and Madera counties. Not everyone likes the idea of a new city in Madera County. Fred Fuerte says he moved to the ranchos from the Bay Area 16 years ago to get away from all this.
The reason I moved here personally is because I like the calm way of life. Something that I've thought about is that maybe Avenue 12 might eventually turn into maybe like a pass-through like Los Manos area, you know, the 152.
Avenue 12 is the main road through the ranchos. Despite local complaints, Madera County Planning Commissioner Tom Hurst says a development is positive for a mainly rural county.
It helps put money in the coffer for Madera County, and this will increase the revenue and also increase the things that the county will have the ability to do. Because there's road impact fees, there's taxes.
This is the next logical place for the region to develop. It's easier to get to River Park and downtown Fresno from this location than it is from many parts in Clovis and southeast Fresno.
That's Tim Jones. He's the principal owner of Riverstone. The 2,100 acres was mainly used for agriculture, and Jones says olive trees already there will line the streets. The project is right off Highway 41 and Avenue 12. Jones says early on, his company sent out 5,000 postcards to people living nearby, asking asking them what they wanted in the community.
Super high-speed internet was one, so we have fiber to the home. Walking trails, we've got trails. Clubhouses that connect people. We have probably one of the nicest clubhouses you will ever go in.
McCaffrey Homes is already selling houses. They're starting at around $300,000. Jones's vision is to create a self-contained place with a dense core, stores, and other amenities. When fully built, people won't have to drive to Fresno to get groceries or gas. Of course, with self-sufficiency comes the topic of water. Many homeowners in the Madera Ranchos have seen the water levels in their private wells drop or even go dry completely during the drought. Jones says that won't be a problem for Riverstone, which will use a combo of purchased water rights, wells, and access to the Root Creek Water District. He says building the development will actually save water.
The development needs about 4,200 acre-feet of water. The actual water demand in the area, by even converting two houses, will use less water than is being used now in agriculture.
Over the last 20 years, there have been several lawsuits over things like water, air quality, and the environment here. But many have been resolved, allowing the development to move forward. For instance, air quality will be mitigated through the purchase of air quality credits, and the city of Fresno dropped a lawsuit over impacts of the development to the area. I reached out to the city of Fresno about Riverstone opening, and they declined to comment, saying they want to focus on the city. Fresno State Urban Planning Professor Michelle Calvaries sees the project as positive for the valley. Her program is funded in part by the builders of Riverstone.
Even though it's in a different county, it's good for all of us. Both can benefit from each other if we stop looking at it as this is an inclusive city and this is an inclusive city, but rather this is an extension of the region.
She says development in this northward pattern in Fresno and now in Madera makes sense as the next logical place to build. USC economics professor Matthew Kahn agrees, but says there will be some negative impacts.
With new housing far from the city center, the homes will be bigger, so the homeowners will love that, but the environmental footprint will be bigger. You'll need more energy for air conditioning, and with sprawl, everything spread out, people will be driving more miles.
The developer says that could start soon, since they've already sold about 20 homes, and residents are expected to move in later this year. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. The early days of President Donald Trump's administration have left all manner of people scrambling to keep up and understand the local impacts of a series of executive orders. One major change is the threat to withhold federal funds from so-called sanctuary cities, that is, communities that claim not to work with Immigration and Customs Enforcement to find immigrants in the country illegally. Later tonight, the Arvin City Council is expected to debate the possibility of becoming a sanctuary city. But in the Valley's largest city, Fresno, FM 89's Jeffrey Hess reports officials are trying to walk a fine line between immigrant-friendly policies and the Trump administration.
When he explained his executive order targeting sanctuary cities, President Trump described the order this way.
The criminals and the drug deals and gangs and gang members and cartel leaders, the day is over when they can stay in our country and wreak havoc.
The promise to do this involved a threat to cut off federal funding to cities that claim to be a safe zone for undocumented immigrants, a place where those without legal permission could reside and be free to contact their local police officer without fear that their immigration status will be questioned. In the most far-reaching cases, local police have pledged not to help ICE in any way at all. Cities across the country have taken public steps to advertise this status and have colloquially become known as sanctuary cities. But almost immediately following the signing of the order, cities began to ask, wait, is that us? Fresno Mayor Lee Brand says Fresno is not an official sanctuary city, but
our official policy is essentially the same as most of the sanctuary cities in California. We simply don't label ourselves a sanctuary city because by making that label and that proposition, then the city itself is jeopardizing federal funding.
Brand says he's in a tight spot. Fresno badly needs federal funding. But he also needs to find a way to balance the demands of being a city in a blue state facing a red administration. Fresno Police Department Policy 428 states that police should serve the public regardless of alien status and that, quote, officers shall not enforce violations of immigration law or status. Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer defends the policy, saying his officers are worried about criminal status, not immigration status. However, he says they do not actively stand in the way of ICE. Dyer is not worried about the federal government pressing his officers into immigration patrols, which he fears could jeopardize relations with Fresno's large Latino community.
But the reality is, if that is truly the focus of the Trump administration, to increase enforcement efforts against those individuals that are here and that are undocumented, then they need to hire more ICE agents and put them in local jurisdictions, but not require police departments to be the enforcement arm for them.
While the city says it is not checking immigration status, that doesn't mean checks aren't being run. The Fresno County Jail, which is run by Sheriff Margaret Mims, does have ICE agents stationed inside to run immigration status checks. Like Brand, Dyer is in a bind. He needs the cooperation of everyone, regardless of immigration status, to work with his officers to fight crime, but also relies on federal funding to help execute the duties of what he considers to be an understaffed department. So Fresno leaders seem to believe that as long as they don't call themselves a sanctuary city, they won't run afoul of the Trump administration, even if their policies are functionally the same. The question is, will the Trump administration see it that way? San Joaquin College School of Law professor Gregory Olson, who runs the New American Legal Clinic, says it's unclear how the administration will determine which cities are and are not sanctuary, because some conservative groups have taken a more hardline view that lumps Fresno in with places like L.A. and San Francisco.
So it all depends on what the federal government's going to do now that it's under Trump's power. Is Trump going to take more of that right-leaning definition, or is he going to look at it more of the way that it's traditionally been seen, where a sanctuary city is a city that's designated and is taking those steps to prevent cooperation with ICE?
Ultimately, Olson says this vagueness from Washington has contributed to confusion on the ground in the Central Valley. Today, the California legislature even held a hearing to consider the possibility of declaring California a sanctuary state, including steps like prohibiting local police departments from spending any money to enforce immigration laws. But Olson points out that part of the problem is an issue of public perception. If undocumented immigrants feel that the Fresno police are being pressed into service on behalf of ICE, even if that's not literally the case, then they may not be willing to come forward and report a crime or be a witness. That is exactly the scenario Police Chief Dyer and Mayor Brand say they're trying to avoid. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
Listening to Valley Edition, I'm Joe Moore. Drive up and down Highway 99 in Fresno County, and you'll no doubt see evidence that California's high-speed rail project is slowly becoming a reality. Well, there's still big questions about how long it will take to finish the project and how the state will pay for it. The Rail Authority says it still hopes to have trains up and running by 2024. Backers often point to the success of high-speed rail in places like Europe and Asia as evidence of the potential it has to change the way we move around the state. One of the countries most often cited is China. So what is the state of high-speed rail there, and what could California learn from the way the Chinese have built and operated their high-speed rail lines? Joining us now is Fresno State Professor Daniel Garst, who recently returned from China, where he spent over a decade as a journalist and policy analyst. Daniel, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm very pleased to talk about this subject.
So give us an overview right now of what high-speed rail is like in China. What's the extent of the line?
Okay.
And is it running right now, or are they still building
Well,
things?
No. China's built within a very short space of time the largest high-speed rail network in the world. They have quite a few lines in the eastern part of the country linking coastal cities together, and also a large number extending into the western part of the country. And the system is still under construction. They're planning to expand it further. I have ridden in Chinese high-speed trains. They leave the station on time. They're very comfortable. They whisk you to a destination at 300 kilometers per hour. So it is a pleasant experience, but the system is not commercially successful in most of its corridors. Most of the corridors are not making any money or not even breaking even. And that's something which California can really learn from China.
So how are the Chinese financing and developing this and operating it?
They're borrowing tons of money. The Chinese Railroad Ministry, which is probably about the most corrupt and dysfunctional department in the Chinese government, and believe me, it's up against some awfully stiff competition in that area. That department has borrowed massive amounts of money. In 2011, its debt stood at $280 billion. Over the past 5 years, that has more than doubled. The latest data I've seen is just under $700 billion. That was back at the start of 2016. It's undoubtedly gone up a lot more. They're financing it by borrowing money. Now, to put that figure in perspective, that figure exceeds the entire national debt of Australia. So we're talking about a staggering sum of money. There's only one corridor in the Chinese system that really breaks even and actually is now turning a profit, and that's the corridor running from Beijing down to Shanghai. And it goes through a lot of heavily populated areas in Zhejiang province and other parts of the country in the east that are pretty advanced economically and well-developed.
Now, is this just a problem of the massive infrastructure it takes to build a high-speed rail line, or is it more of an operational issue?
No, the issue is the basic economics of high-speed rail. High-speed rail is exceedingly expensive to build. In China, the costs are 2 to 3 times what it takes to build conventional rail lines. You have to build special rail tracks because of the speed of high-speed trains when they make a curve. And bear in mind, too, that in China, the costs are lower than they would be in California because you don't have pesky right-of-way issues. The state does compensate farmers and people for their land, but it's kind of, yeah, you take it or leave it. And so they don't get tied up with legal issues and lawsuits and all that other stuff. So the trains are really expensive to build. The lines are expensive to build. The trains are expensive to operate. And consequently, the HSR, to be profitable, needs massive ridership. And you need to charge high ticket prices. So it needs to flow through areas that are densely populated with lots of affluent people. And the Beijing to Shanghai corridor meets that criteria. It's passing through some really large cities. There's a lot of business travelers, a lot of upper middle class people wanting to get quickly from one place to another. And it's much more convenient to do it by HSR in China than by air, because Chinese airports are terrible. They have the worst record in the world when it comes to on-time arrivals and departures. So they take that, and to give you some numbers, 250 trains go through that corridor every day. And last year, I think in 2016 or 2015, 100 million people travel down the Beijing to Shanghai HSR corridor. That's a huge volume of passenger traffic. And likewise, there's another corridor they have, a line running from Beijing to Tianjin. Tianjin is a short hop from Beijing. It's the port. And that has become so heavily traveled, they're building a second line. And it's very convenient. You try to drive to Tianjin out of Beijing, the traffic is so bloody awful that you would take several hours to get there, and you take the train, it's 35 minutes. So those are the lessons. Now, do you have those conditions replicated in California? That is the issue we need to talk about, I think, with respect to California high-speed rail and about its commercial viability.
You mentioned Shanghai to Beijing, an analog perhaps to L.A. and San Francisco?
I think L.A. to San Francisco could work because this is kind of the HSR sweet spot. You're talking about probably a medium-length journey that's about 2 hours. I don't know, how many kilometers is it from Los Angeles to San Francisco, probably 600 kilometers or so. At any rate, it's likely a 2 to 3 hour train journey. And if you routed this line directly from Los Angeles up the Salinas Valley, along the coast, Dog Lake to Salinas Valley, and up to San Francisco, maybe have stops in Santa Barbara, Salinas, and Monterey, That would be getting you to San Francisco pretty quickly, and it would be competitive with respect to time to flying, because with flying, you got to go to the airport, you got to go through security, which is kind of troublesome and time-consuming. Also on a train, you can take liquids, you can, you know, you're less constrained on what you can carry on board. So I think you could generate enough passenger volume for the line to be commercially viable if it was routed in that way.
Of course, we know California's line is not routed there. Part of the thinking there is that the growth areas in Central California, Fresno, Bakersfield, these communities will encompass much of the state's new population growth moving forward. And so the line is routed through here rather than on the I-5 corridor, as you say, along the coast.
Yeah, I think I can understand why Brown wanted to do that, why the government wants to have it run through the Central Valley. But I'm not quite sure you have, A, the number of affluent people who would want to go by HSR. And the other problem you have as well is kind of a practical issue of once you get out of the train in a town like Bakersfield or Fresno, how do you get around? Now, with San Francisco and L.A., you go directly to those cities, and you have public transportation, certainly in San Francisco, and now increasingly in L.A. L.A. is building a pretty good subway system. And that's the advantage, again, to go back to China. Beijing has now the fourth busiest subway system in the world. It's wonderful. Shanghai has a good subway system. And all these cities along the way are building their own mass transit systems. That's one area where China isn't wasting money in infrastructure spending. So I think I hope it works out down the road. But my fear is that we're looking at what's probably going to be an expensive white elephant.
Daniel Garst joining us on Valley Public Radio today, talking about high-speed rail in China. Dan, the Chinese system is different than ours. Corporations and the state have a different relationship than they do here in California in the U.S. Does China's high-speed rail line have private investment, private operation? Here in California, the proposal at least calls for private companies to operate the trains and also calls for outside investment. That hasn't happened yet. The rail authority says it's too early for that. But how does the system operate in that sense in China? Is private enterprise involved or is it all state run?
It's basically all state run. China National Rail Corporation is a state-owned company. And we're talking not just about the state building the line, but also state ownership or state-owned companies building the high-speed locomotives. China builds their own HSR locomotives. They reverse engineered the ones from Siemens, and they're very proud of that accomplishment. And they work reasonably well, I guess.
Dan, there's also a good bit of talk about where this investment, this private investment, this outside investment in California's high-speed rail line is going to come from. Do you think China might perhaps be one of those places?
Certainly, yeah. The Chinese might want to invest in it. And one of the things that's going to affect the cost of a California HSR system, and this is how this illustrates how trade, you know, affects all of our lives and is interrelated with everything. If President Trump has a trade war with China, that will further drive the cost of this HSR line up, because in the absence of a trade war with China, we can build it with cheap imported Chinese steel. And that won't be possible if there's a 45% tariff duty. And also the other issue is, where do you get the locomotives from? America doesn't produce high-speed locomotives. They would have to come from possibly China, which does manufacture them, or from France or Germany. So trade and the Trump administration policies on trade are going to have a big impact on how this project unfolds, and it's costs and whether it will be viable down the road.
Daniel Garst joining us today on Valley Edition, talking about China's high-speed rail system. He's written about the issue in the journal China Capitalist in an article called Off the Rails, China's Central Asian High-Speed Rail Dreams. That's available online at his website, danielgarst.com. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It was great to talk about this issue.
And stay with us in the second part of our program today. We'll learn about a new effort to expand partnerships between Valley Children's Hospital and Cahuilla Delta Medical Center in Tulare County.
plus an effort in Bakersfield to raise awareness about human trafficking through a coffee shop that employs victims of human trafficking. That's all coming up straight ahead on Valley Edition.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Lourdes Garcia,
Alice Fuller,
Ari Shapiro,
NPR News,
Monrovia,
Sao Paulo,
Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, streets, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Listen weekdays, 3 a.m. to 9, to Morning Edition on Valley Public Radio.
I'm Cokie Roberts. I've been at NPR so long, I can remember when Robert Siegel had hair. Not really. But one thing here has never changed, the amount of care and creativity that's put into our programs every day. Believe it or not, that old car in your driveway can be part of that daily effort. When you donate it to this station, you'll help pay for the coverage and the programs you love. Here's how.
Turn vehicles into programs at kvpr.org.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Last week, the Fresno City Council voted to enact a rental housing inspection program aimed at cracking down on slum housing in the city. The decision clears a long simmering issue in the city about substandard living conditions for some of the most vulnerable residents in the community. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports the deal actually pleased groups that have often been on opposite sides of the issue.
The 4-3 vote came after more than 2 hours of public comment. Most people spoke in favor of the program, including the influential Apartment Association of Greater Fresno, which represents owners and managers, as well as tenants' rights advocates like Matthew Gundry. He told the council stories about homes and apartments with untreated pest infestations, black mold, and more that goes ignored by landlords.
So I urge you, I compel you to consider yourselves. I'm a father of 5 children. Consider yourselves your own children, and would it be acceptable to allow them to live in these conditions? Thank you very much.
The activist groups No More Slumlords, Faith in Community, and Building Healthy Communities, who've been leading the charge for more inspections, all supported the plan. For the first time, the city will begin the process of setting a baseline inspection regime to get a sense of how much unsafe or substandard housing exists among the roughly 85,000 rental apartments and homes. All rental units will be required to register with the city. For large apartment complexes, 10% of the units will be inspected. Once inspected, units will be put into one of 3 tiers. The top tier will be subject to fewer follow-up inspections than the lower 2 tiers. Greg Terzakis with the Apartment Association of Greater Fresno expressed pleasure at the ability to find common ground with the community activists who have at times been highly critical of the landlords.
We could sit here all night long and arguing about whether or not this is a perfect ordinance or not. It isn't, and I don't know that one could be written. But we do know that something needs to be done to address substandard housing. And we hope that the council will pass this tonight so we can begin that process.
Concerns about the prevalence of slum housing conditions in Fresno came to a head in late 2015. That's when the city found hundreds of people living without gas or hot water at the Somerset Village apartment complex. Subsequently, a string of media reports highlighted some of the worst conditions in the city. Councilmembers Steve Brandau, Clint Olivier, and Gary Bredefeld all voted against the plan. Bredefeld warned about the potential for lawsuits against the city based on violations of renters' privacy rights.
There is a thing called the Fourth Amendment. I respect the Fourth Amendment. There are cities, like in Garland, Texas, where people have sued the city over the Fourth Amendment. People coming in and forcing inspections. It's something we can't just ignore because you may not like it.
Don Scordino is the director of the Fresno Association of Realtors, which opposed the ordinance. He says focusing only on landlords misses the point.
But I agree, there is a problem. But the problem, I believe, needs to be solved by greater tenant education. And in this document that's 13 pages long, there's only 2 sentences that deal with tenant education.
Part of the ordinance does include the development of a tenant education program designed in conjunction with public, private, and nonprofit groups. Following the vote, supporters of the plan cheered and pumped their fists in the air.
Motion carries 4 yes, 3 no. Council members Bredefeld, Brandau, and Olivier voting no.
The vote is the culmination of years of debate. It's also the first test for new Mayor Lee Brandt. The council nearly acted on the issue in the waning days of the Ashley Swearingen administration, before pushing it back to the new year. Unlike Brand's proposal, Swearingen's plan would not have included a baseline inspection provision. Before the vote, Brand urged support from the council, saying that his plan is a sensible one that balances the needs of landlords and renters.
It's one thing to bring a policy forward that sounds ambitious but doesn't work. This was designed specifically to tackle this enormous problem.
Brand says he has nearly four decades of experience in property management and used that and his ties with the industry to help craft the plan. He hopes to have the first round of inspections complete within 2 years and have all units sorted into different tiers and in a self-inspection pool in 5 years. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Two of the largest players in healthcare in the Valley have announced they're working closer together. It involves Valley Children's Hospital in Madera and Kaweah Delta Medical Center in Visalia. Here to tell us more about the partnership and how it involves the neonatal intensive care unit in Tulare County is Todd Sundrapak, the CEO of Children's. Todd, welcome.
Thank you, Joe. Good morning.
So you've announced this partnership with Kaweah Delta. What does it exactly involve? You're working with them with the NICU. How is this partnership evolving?
That's a great question. And before I get into the NICU partnership directly, Joe, I just want to remind everybody that we've worked in partnership with Kaweah Delta for decades now. Our pediatric subspecialists, many of them, have gone down to Kaweah Delta through an arrangement to provide care closer to where patients live in Tulare County for many, many decades now. This is the next step in the evolution of us working closer together with the NICU and the pediatric hospitalist programs there. But just back about 12 months ago now, we also partnered with Kaweah Delta at their request to provide maternal-fetal medicine specialists to help with high-risk deliveries and moms that are at risk for difficult delivery for Kaweah Delta. So it's all kind of coming together. But specific to the NICU, Joe, what this means is that Valley Children's physicians, through our affiliate medical foundation, our medical group, will provide 24/7 coverage at Kaweah Delta 365 days a year. And that's through a combination of neonatologists that will live and work in that community once we're fully staffed, and also neonatal nurse practitioners that have very specialized training. And so for the people of Visalia and their surrounding communities in Tulare County, what it'll mean is a higher level of care and a clinical practitioner that's on hand to intervene on behalf of a neonate 24/7, which really is the standard that Valley Children's is committed to whenever we staff a level 3 neonatal intensive care unit, which the unit at Kaweah Delta is a level 3, so it only makes sense.
So what's the timeline like on all of this? When does this actually take place?
This actually started, Joe, on February 1st of 2017, and a little bit ahead of schedule. We had planned to start in March, but through a number of different iterations, I guess, from what my team has shared, we had the request to move up the coverage to February 1st, which we've met. And so today, Valley Children's is staffing the NICU at Kaweah Delta, which really, Joe, means that families will be able to stay closer to home, closer to where their loved ones are that can support them through times that may be scary. So that if there are multiple siblings in a family, mom and dad can return home at night without making a long drive and be with the rest of their family. So it's a great thing, I think, and one we're committed to in enhancing access to the highest level of care. It's a great thing for the people of Visalia and Tulare County. And I want to just not move over this too quickly. It's an incredible, in my opinion, demonstration of commitment and leadership by Kauai Delta to the families that they serve. I mean, they really are leading the way in making this possible to keep more kids and families closer to home.
If you just joined us on Valley Public Radio today, we're talking to Valley Children's CEO Todd Sunterpack about their expanded partnership with Visalia's Kauai Delta Medical Center. In this case, it involves the neonatal intensive care unit where Valley Children's will provide physicians and others to work there and staff that unit. Anytime there's a big change, Todd, sometimes that also brings about controversy or other questions. Kauai Delta had been working with another physicians group, Sequoia Pediatric Group, and there's some concern. There was an article in the Bee just a few days ago about objections to what they termed as a closed system, meaning that those physicians from the other group wouldn't be allowed into this NICU that's now being run in partnership with your hospital and Kauai Delta. Can you address that? Is this a closed system, and what does that mean?
Well, I think I appreciate the question, Joe, and I think I do want to draw some delineation here between the actions that Kauai Delta District Hospital is taking through their appropriate and very clearly articulated governance procedures to take an action to close the unit, which is foundationally set in their assessment that they need to guarantee a certain level of quality of clinical care provided in this particular area of their hospital, being the neonatal intensive care unit. And as you say, there have been some articles. What I can tell you is that, to my knowledge, all of the appropriate governance processes, steps, and procedures at Kauai Delta have been taken to take that action. Although I obviously am not the CEO of Kauai Delta, nor am I an employee, and I have not participated in those discussions at Kauai Delta, so I can't give you more in terms of the tactics, but I do know that their decision was anchored in discussions about ensuring a certain level of quality of care that is their expectation in their organization. And it's not closed units at Kauai Delta anyway. I think there are other departments that are closed, meaning only one group, medical group, that is engaged typically through what's referred to as a coverage agreement to meet those quality standards. So other departments at Kauai Delta are closed. Most neonatal intensive care units do have one neonatal medical group providing care there, whether the unit is closed or not, just as a de facto course of practice, for some similar reasons, to ensure that there is continuity in care, that there is comprehensive coordination of care of patients, that is typically done by one group to ensure that, so that there, in most cases, are not multiple practitioners that care is struggling to be standardized through and those kinds of things. So whether the unit is closed or not, just generally, and this is in a national context, it is typical for one neonatal group to have accountability for the clinical quality in any given NICU.
Before we go, you were talking about this expansion and this partnership with Kauai Delta that's been going back years. You're also working with hospitals up and down the valley. I know that you've made a lot of strides in Kern County and working with hospitals there and strengthening your partnerships. What's the status of that in Kern County right now?
Oh, I appreciate you asking that question very much. We have, for a number of years now, had a very similar arrangement to the one that we've just discussed at Kauai Delta with Bakersfield Memorial Hospital, where Valley Children's doctors provide the medical care in the Bakersfield Memorial Pediatric Intensive Care Unit, so not the neonatal, but the Pediatric Intensive Care Unit, which also lets patients that are critically ill stay closer to home there in Bakersfield. And just like Kauai Delta, we provide pediatric hospitalists at Bakersfield Memorial Hospital. And so just like Kauai Delta, patients that are not necessarily critically ill but need inpatient stays to get well, our doctors are there providing care for them every day, just like they will be at Kauai Delta. The other really important feature, I think, about pediatric hospitalist programs associated with Valley Children's are that our hospitalists, whether it's at Bakersfield Memorial or Kauai Delta, respond to the ER. When a child presents at Bakersfield Memorial's ER, our hospitalists are there to come down and help out and take over care if needed, certainly to advise. Similarly, the case will be at Kauai Delta. But in addition to the inpatient services we're providing down in Bakersfield, we've also, earlier this year, last year actually, in 2016, we acquired a 10-acre campus on Stockdale, right across from the Christian High School that Derek Carr's brother is the head football coach, and where Derek went to high school. And we are going to be building 50 to 60,000 square foot pediatric subspecialty campus so that we can, again, have doctors that are part of Valley Children's but live and work and provide care in Bakersfield closer to where patients live. So this is all tied to our goal to achieve the best access for pediatric care with our partners for kids around the valley. And similarly, up in Visalia, last year we opened our Acres campus, which is a specialty care center, and we will be expanding that location once we find appropriate property to purchase, and then we will build a similar 40 to 50,000 square foot specialty care center in the city of Visalia.
Valley Children's CEO Todd Sundrapak talking with us today about their expanded partnerships up and down the valley, including at the NICU at Kauai Delta Medical Center in Visalia. Todd, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
This is Valley Edition. A new coffee shop in Bakersfield offers more than just lattes and blended drinks. It also seeks to raise awareness about human trafficking. In fact, many of the people who work at the Rescue Grounds Coffee Company at Bakersfield Memorial Hospital are victims of human trafficking themselves. It's all part of a project from the Bakersfield nonprofit Magdalene Hope. Its founder, Doug Bennett, joins us now on Valley Edition. Doug, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me. How you doing, Joe?
Doing great. Doug, where did the idea of this project come from?
You know, it's kind of crazy how we operate with Magdalene Hope. We were having a board meeting back in June of last year and shoot some fundraising ideas around, some public awareness ideas, and also a way to employ the women. We have a safe house about an hour out of Bakersfield, a safe shelter for women that we rescue out of the lifestyle, and we offer them an opportunity to earn a college degree through a college here in Bakersfield, but we've never had the opportunity to employ them. And I guess maybe early of last year, I was in talks with a couple of producers in Hollywood about doing a reality show that would follow me around with cameras and just follow my life around, you know, with the shelter and rescuing and the women we work with. And we came up with the name Rescue Grounds, and we kind of laughed and said, man, if we ever open a coffee shop, we got a great name. And when our meeting in June, as we were talking as a board, one of our board members actually works at Bakersfield Memorial Hospital. And she said, hey, the coffee kiosk is available. We could open a coffee shop. And another board member said, hey, my brother owns Spearhead Coffee in Paso Robles, and I'm sure he'd give you a great deal. So it was just kind of one thing led to another. We had a meeting with the vice president, and not being in the coffee business, we just kind of sold him on me being the Humanitarian of the Year award winner for 2016 for Bakersfield, and just said, hey, here's a guy that's doing solid work in your town who's rescuing women. How about giving us a shot at a coffee shop? And he did, and we opened Rescue Grounds Coffee Company last month.
So how is it working so far, and what has the response been in the community?
Man, the response has been overwhelmingly just an outpouring of love and compassion by this community. This community is amazing in just the way that they support efforts from individuals and from organizations trying to make a difference in this town. So we've had quite a bit of support. We've had some people coming out, and I think it's just more of getting the word out and whatnot. I think we're about break even each day, which from what I hear for a new business, especially a food or coffee shop, is pretty good. You know, the partnership with Spearhead Coffee is we have they were voted the 16th best coffee shop in the United States by Food Network. So we have a quality product. And then we've also gotten some local vendors to partner with us to carry their baked goods. So Smith's Bakery, Jake's Tex-Mex Restaurant, we have Jake's Cake for sale. We have Hodel Cinnamon Rolls and Berrylicious Pies, fried pies and cobbler. So I can't.
Sounds delicious. Sounds delicious.
It is. I can't sell anything hot to compete with the cafeteria, but I can sell ready-made food. And so that's why I went with the best bakeries that I know of in our region, and then offer those to our customers.
Tell me more about the women who work there and their stories, and how has this changed their lives?
You know, we have a couple of survivors. So we have a shelter that we rescue the women to. We offer a one-year program. It's called Restoration Ranch. And once they graduate, we offer them 9 months of transitional housing so they can transition back in, get a job, save up some money, and then we help them get a place and get back on their feet. And get them doing something other than being sold or selling themselves. And so we have two survivors that graduated our program. They also graduated from Summit Bible College, and they've come on board to work with us. And they're very thankful, and we're very thankful to partner with them again and to work with them. So we're really, really, really excited to have them on board.
So it's at Bakersfield Memorial Hospital. Where can people find it at the hospital?
So that's at 420 34th Street, and it's just inside the main entrance. So as you come in the main entrance on 34th, it's at the end of the hallway, Rescue Grounds Coffee Company. It's a really good product, and we have really good prices.
Is there a lot more need for opportunities for victims of human trafficking like this to be able to get a job and transition back into a more normal lifestyle?
Yes, unfortunately, a lot of the women that are sold, you know, they're held against their will, they're drugged, they're put out on the street. It's a horrific crime against humanity. And a lot of these women who are out there who are being sold, they get court cases against them, and makes it difficult for them to find employment. So, yeah, we thought it was key to offer them a way to earn a living and be effective in our society.
Again, it's called Rescue Grounds Coffee Company at Bakersfield Memorial Hospital. The goal is to raise awareness about human trafficking and provide jobs for the victims of human trafficking. The founder of Magdalene Hope is with us today, Doug Bennett. Doug, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Joe. Hey, real quick. Dignity Health at Bakersfield Memorial Hospital has been amazing, and they offered us 1 year free rent, 1 year free water, 1 year free electricity, all at no cost for us, just to partner with us to help change these survivors' lives. And we just want to thank them for that.
Sounds like a great partnership indeed. Again, Doug Bennett with Magdalene Hope. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Joe.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org, and also tweet us. We are at KVPR and at Valley Edition. While you're online, go to our website, kvpr.org, for audio archives and our podcast as well. Again, that's kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.